Imagine for a second, walking into a world-renowned art museum.
Okay, I am picturing it.
Right. So you wander through the quiet halls, you turn a corner, and there it is. It's an absolute masterpiece. We are talking about a painting that took years of just, meticulous, loving effort to
The
craft.
kind of art that just completely draws you in.
Exactly. The colors are incredibly vibrant, the composition is flawless, but as you step closer to really admire the brushwork, you realize something horrifying.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Someone has snuck in during the middle of the night and spray painted this cheap, blindingly neon graffiti all over the canvas.
Oh wow, that is painful to even think about.
It is the original beauty, the artist's profound intent. It's almost entirely obscured by something chaotic and destructive. And that tension, that tragic distance between original breathtaking beauty and destructive vandalism, that is the exact framework we are exploring today with you, our beloved family.
It really is a profound sense of loss when you think about that vandalized canvas. You are no longer looking at the masterpiece. Your eyes are just forcefully drawn to the vandalism.
Right, you can't look away from the neon paint.
Exactly. And the tragedy is that the graffiti demands your attention, blinding you to the intricate beauty underneath. So the mission of our journey today is to unpack how ancient biblical wisdom, specifically focusing on the Gospel of Matthew, diagnoses our very modern struggles with distraction, addiction, and, well, desire.
Because it's something we all face, right?
Oh, absolutely. We are looking at a framework presented in the sermon today that attempts to reclaim that original beauty. It's about peeling back the neon graffiti of our modern culture.
Because if we're being completely honest, the modern world often treats sex as just a tool. I mean, it is framed as a mechanism for instantaneous peripheral pleasure.
It's extremely casual.
Yeah, it's casual, it's highly commercialized, and it is everywhere. But the perspective we are analyzing today, it argues something profoundly different.
It really does.
The sermon posits that human sexuality is actually a beautiful divine gift,
Yeah.
like a crucial part of an original perfect creation.
It is the masterpiece.
Yes, the masterpiece. But its design has been deeply corrupted by our cultural norms.
And to understand how to restore that masterpiece, or, even just how to stop adding our own layers of graffiti to it, the framework we are exploring insists we have to understand where the vandalism actually begins.
Right, which isn't always obvious.
No, it's not. The argument here is that the battle doesn't start where we typically think it does. It doesn't begin with a physical action or like a compromised situation. The sermon argues it starts entirely internally.
So let's break down the history behind that, because the sermon contrasts the ancient Pharisees with the teachings of Jesus in the fifth chapter of Matthew.
Right, the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah. Historically, those religious leaders, the Pharisees, they restricted the definition of sin purely to the actual physical act of adultery.
It was an incredibly binary system.
Very binary. It was just, did you physically cross this tangible line, yes or no?
And humans naturally gravitate toward binary systems because, well, they are comfortable. A physical checklist is measurable. It is entirely external.
You just tick the box.
Exactly. You could look at your life, check a box, and declare, well, I haven't physically committed this act, so I am perfectly moral. It requires absolutely no internal self-reflection or, psychological heavy lifting.
Right. You could be a mess inside.
Oh, you can harbor incredible darkness internally. But as long as you don't act on it physically, the rule book says you are clean.
But the sermon points out that Jesus completely upends that comfortable external checklist. He relocates the battlefield from the physical world straight into the mind.
Which is a terrifying shift for a lot of people.
It really is. And reading through this, I have to play devil's advocate for a moment for our beloved family members.
Go for it.
If the argument is that merely having a thought or noticing someone is a profound moral failure, that sounds like an impossible standard. I mean, biology dictates that we notice things.
Sure, we are wired that way.
Exactly. If a beautiful person walks into a room, the human eye is naturally drawn to them. You can't just turn off your vision.
And that biological reality is actually addressed quite clearly in the sermon. The distinction being made is not about the initial involuntary glance.
Okay, so noticing is fine.
Yes, naturally noticing beauty is a normal human reaction. The critical mechanism here is intentionality. The warning directed at harboring lust is about what happens after the initial glance.
After you've already noticed.
Right. It's when the gaze is allowed to linger. It's the conscious decision to enjoy and cultivate a sexual imagination.
Wow, cultivate is a strong word there.
It implies work, right? The sermon argues that the imagination is not some harmless, isolated playground where actions have no consequences. Rather, it's the active preparation stage for physical reality.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy. It's kind of the difference between noticing a stray spark from a campfire landing on the dirt.
Which happens all the time.
Right, which is just natural physics, something you can't necessarily control. But the danger is intentionally pouring a gallon of gasoline on that spark to see how massive the fire can get.
That is a perfect way to visualize it.
The danger highlighted in the sermon lies in actively holding on to the spark and choosing to feed it.
And that mechanism of feeding the spark, it shifts a person from being a passive observer of their environment to an active participant in their own temptation.
You're no longer just watching, you're building it.
Psychologically speaking, yeah, you are no longer just processing visual data. You are actively constructing an internal alternate reality.
Which is exhausting just to think about.
It is. And the perspective presented in the sermon suggests that once you begin curating that internal reality, the moral boundary has already been breached. The eventual physical act is simply a symptom.
It's already happened in the mind.
Exactly. It's a delayed but inevitable manifestation of a mind that has already surrendered its defenses.
Man, well, it's easy to discuss sparks and internal realities in theory. But when human biology kicks in, how does anyone actually manage that?
It's incredibly difficult.
Right. And the sermon provides two historical case studies to illustrate the practical fallout of this gaze management, starting with King David.
Oh, David presents such a fascinating psychological profile in this context.
He really does.
Because here is a giant slayer, right? A brilliant military tactician and a celebrated poet. He had unparalleled power and resources, yet the breakdown of his legacy didn't happen because he accidentally saw Bathsheba from his rooftop.
No, looking at the sequence of events detailed in the sermon, David's downfall was entirely a failure of managing that second glance.
He was idle when he should have been at war.
Yeah, he saw something, and instead of turning away and starving the spark like we just talked about, he lingered. He demanded the gasoline.
He actively fed the fire.
Exactly. And the sermon makes a really sharp point here about the nature of lust. It points out that lust possesses absolutely no patience. It demands instantaneous gratification.
It wants everything right now.
Right now. It's impulsive and inherently destructive, which is sharply contrasted in the sermon with the biblical story of Jacob, who patiently worked for 7 grueling years to marry the woman he loved.
That is a stark contrast.
It really is. The sermon says love endures delay, but lust demands the now.
And that ravenous demand for the now is what paralyzes the moral compass. David's intentional gaze blinded him to literally everything else. His kingdom, his own morality, and the humanity of the people he ultimately destroyed to cover up his indiscretion.
Because he couldn't look away.
Right. But the second case study the sermon brings up, Joseph in the house of Potiphar, it provides a radically different blueprint for handling the spark.
Joseph's situation is intense. I mean, he is facing aggressive, persistent temptation from Potiphar's wife.
She was relentless, according to the text.
She has him cornered. And his response wasn't to stay in the room and argue theology with her.
No, he didn't try to debate his way out of it.
He didn't try to prove the strength of his willpower or his moral superiority. The sermon highlights that he left his cloak in her hands and literally sprinted out of the house. He fled.
He just ran.
But wait, here's where it gets really interesting for our beloved family. Culturally, that sounds incredibly cowardly.
It does go against the grain.
Yeah, we celebrate heroes who stand their ground, you know? They plant their feet and they overcome the enemy face to face. Is the text really advocating that the ultimate heroic move in the face of temptation is to run away terrified?
Well, the sermon directly challenges our cultural definition of heroism here. True wisdom, according to this framework, isn't believing you are invincible. It's possessing the hyper-awareness to know exactly where you are vulnerable.
Oh, that's good. Knowing your weak spots.
Exactly. And the sermon cites Job chapter 31, verse 1, where Job discusses making a binding covenant with his eyes not to look lustfully.
A covenant with his eyes.
Right. A pre-made decision. It also points to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18, which explicitly commands people to, quote, flee sexual immorality.
Yeah.
The profound strategic wisdom here is the recognition that some battles are completely unwinnable if fought face to face.
They are just too big for us.
Yeah. They're designed to be actively avoided, not conquered in hand-to-hand combat.
Because if you stand there and try to fight the temptation on its own terms, you are keeping the spark alive simply by remaining in the room.
You're still holding the gas.
Exactly. You are relying on your own exhaustion-prone willpower rather than just changing the environment.
By staying, you are trusting a flawed internal system against a rigged external environment. Joseph recognized that the room itself was compromised. He didn't try to negotiate with Hazard. He removed himself from the visual and physical stimuli entirely.
Okay, bringing this into the present moment for our beloved family. Running away makes logical sense in an ancient palace. You leave a room, you step out into the desert, the temptation is physically gone.
It's geography.
Right, but how on earth do you flee when the temptation is sitting right in your pocket? You can't sprint away from a smartphone.
That is the modern dilemma, isn't it?
It travels with you. It sleeps next to you.
And this is where the sermon transitions into some of the most intense imagery Jesus utilizes. The commands are visceral. Things like, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away.
That is intense.
Or, if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. Now, the sermon is very careful to clarify that this is not an endorsement of literal physical self-mutilation.
Which is a very necessary clarification for everyone listening. I mean, for our beloved family members.
Definitely. But if it isn't literal, it is clearly a metaphor demanding a ruthless, uncompromising attitude. The sermon refers to this as radical amputation.
Radical amputation.
Yes. It's the deliberate severing of the habits, the apps, the environments, or the daily routines that consistently act as the gasoline for that spark.
You have to be aggressive about it.
The argument is that you have to aggressively cut off the roots of the sin. And the sermon emphasizes how urgent this is today by comparing our modern digital landscape to being ruled by the harlot mentioned in the book of Revelation.
Oh, wow. That is a heavy comparison.
It is. Through the internet, temptation isn't just an occasional visitor in a specific room anymore. It is the water we swim in.
So what does this all mean for us today, practically? The crucial observation the sermon makes about modern media is the element of frictionless access.
Frictionless is the perfect word.
It isn't just the sheer volume of content out there. It's the lack of any barrier to entry. Making small, seemingly insignificant compromises, like a quick glance here, 5 minutes of scrolling there, it leads directly to a state the sermon defines as the paralysis of one's internal system.
The paralysis of one's internal system. Let's really dig into the mechanics of that.
Yeah, please do.
Because it implies that your brakes are completely gone, you're sitting in the driver's seat, you're frantically pressing the pedal to stop, but the vehicle is entirely unresponsive to your commands.
It's a terrifying feeling.
Biologically and psychologically, according to the sermon, that is exactly what happens. When you introduce frictionless access to highly stimulating digital pleasure, you are flooding the brain with unnatural levels of dopamine.
Right, the reward chemical.
Exactly. And the brain attempts to balance this by downregulating its own dopamine receptors. Suddenly, normal life feels dull.
Oh, so you need more just to feel normal.
Yes, you require more intense stimulation just to reach a baseline. This constant flooding effectively bypasses the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain responsible for logical decision-making and impulse control.
So the brakes literally are disconnected.
Literally.
Yeah.
The paralysis the sermon describes is the terrifying point where your neurological willpower is physically incapable of overriding your neurochemistry. The addiction runs on autopilot, and the sermon warns that the inevitable destination of this paralyzed internal system is absolute destruction.
Man, so if the end result of casual digital compromise is literal neurological paralysis, how do we apply this radical amputation today?
We have to build barriers.
Right, but if we can't throw our phones into the ocean and move to a remote cave, how does our beloved family set up these guardrails?
The sermon suggests the first step is brutal honesty regarding personal vulnerabilities. Radical amputation involves intentionally reintroducing friction into a frictionless environment.
Make it harder to mess up.
Exactly. That might mean downgrading to a basic phone that just can't access certain platforms.
Like a flip phone.
Yeah, a flip phone. Or it might involve installing strict accountability software or establishing a non-negotiable rule that smartphones never enter the bedroom.
That's a huge one for a lot of people.
It means treating digital threats with the exact same life or death seriousness that you would treat a physical intruder in your home. You don't try to negotiate with an app that consistently trips you up. You amputate it from your life entirely.
It's about building fences miles away from the cliff's edge, rather than strutting along the precipice and just hoping your balance holds.
That's a great way to put it.
But this raises a massive logistical problem. If we radically cut out the bad habits, delete the apps, clear the histories, and flee the temptation like Joseph, we are left with a massive, echoing void.
And nature abhors a vacuum.
Right. Willpower alone, just gritting your teeth and repeating no 1,000 times a day, that cannot sustain a human being indefinitely.
No, a void cannot remain empty, which is why the sermon introduces the philosophical insights of C.S. Lewis.
Ah, C.S. Lewis. Always profound.
Always. The sermon utilizes Lewis's framework to make a really deep theological point. It says that at the very core of our misplaced, destructive, and impulsive sexual cravings is actually a deep, unfulfilled, and misdirected hunger for the divine.
Wait, really? That reframes the entire struggle.
It completely flips it upside down.
The sermon is suggesting that people fall into these destructive addictions not simply because they lack moral fiber, but because humans are wired with an infinite hunger. And we are desperately attempting to feed a God-sized appetite with digital fast food.
That is exactly the diagnosis. We are finite creatures trying to extract ultimate transcendent satisfaction from finite temporary things.
Which is impossible.
Is a mathematical impossibility. The sermon posits that true freedom from this endless cycle of consumption only arrives when the reality of Psalm 23, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing, when that transitions from a nice poetic thought into a lived daily reality.
I lack nothing. That's the key.
Right. The argument is that only an individual who finds their deepest, most authentic satisfaction in God is insulated from becoming a slave to their own passing desires.
To put a biological spin on this for our beloved family, it is exactly like wandering through a scorching desert, dying of dehydration, and stumbling upon a puddle of salt water.
Ooh, salt water. That is dangerous.
It is. Your body is screaming for hydration, so you chug it. And as the water hits your throat, it mimics the sensation of relief. It feels like you were solving the problem.
But you're actually making it worse.
So much worse. The biological mechanism of drinking salt water is brutal. Your kidneys require more water to flush out the excess sodium than was actually in the salt water you drank.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So your body starts pulling water from its own healthy cells just to process the poison.
Mm.
You are literally dehydrating yourself from the inside out in a desperate attempt to feel full.
That is a terrifying image.
But the sermon is arguing that finding ultimate satisfaction in God is the only source of fresh water that actually cures the cellular thirst without destroying the body.
The salt water mechanism perfectly mirrors the theological diagnosis of addiction presented here.
Mm-hmm.
And the sermon extends this freshwater paradigm directly into the realm of human relationships, particularly within the boundaries of a marriage covenant.
And this is where the masterpiece gets fully restored.
Finally, we get back to the masterpiece.
Yes. The sermon outlines how, within the specific framework of marriage, sex is no longer about satisfying a selfish, ravenous urge. It ceases to be an act of consumption.
It's not about what you can take.
Right. Instead, it is transformed into offering purity and intimacy as a profound, selfless gift to a spouse.
It is a complete inversion of the modern transactional narrative. Society frequently frames intimacy around the question of, well, what can I extract from this interaction to soothe my own needs?
It's just more salt water.
Exactly. The framework presented in the sermon moves from that mindset of selfish extraction to a mindset of mutual blessing. It elevates the physical act into a cultivation of spiritual unity.
But inevitably, we run into the reality of human nature.
We always do.
If this fresh water is available, if this beautiful design for mutual blessing exists, why do we constantly drift back toward the salt water? Why is it so incredibly difficult to maintain the standard?
The sermon addresses this reality head on by pointing directly to the fragility of human resolve. It issues a stark, uncompromising warning. If you don't kill sin, sin will kill you.
That is a heavy statement.
There is no demilitarized zone. You are either actively starving the spark, or the fire is slowly consuming your house. And the tragic reality of human weakness is that successfully navigating temptation yesterday provides zero guarantee of victory today.
The battery drains completely overnight.
It really does.
It's a daily reset for our beloved family. You can't run on yesterday's spiritual battery charge. You have to plug in every single morning. We cannot out-willpower an entire global infrastructure designed to hijack our dopamine receptors.
And the sermon acknowledges that personal willpower is fundamentally insufficient for this task. It is too easily exhausted by stress, fatigue, or just simple proximity to temptation.
We get tired.
We do. Therefore, the ultimate solution presented in the sermon drawing from the 8th chapter of the book of Romans is a desperate daily reliance on the Holy Spirit.
Reliance, not just trying harder.
Right. The assertion is that only when the Spirit actively governs the internal system can a person consistently live out the restored, masterpiece intended for them.
Which means the author's ultimate conclusion is built on a massive paradox.
How so?
Well, true strength against temptation doesn't come from flexing our moral muscles or proving how resilient our willpower is. True strength is actually found in total surrender.
Ah, yes. Surrendering control.
It comes from admitting our complete inability to win this war in isolation and handing the keys of our internal system over to the Holy Spirit every single morning.
Victory through surrender. It is a comprehensive framework for restoration. I mean, we've traced the journey today from recognizing the vandalized masterpiece of human sexuality to understanding the intentionality of the mind.
The campfire spark.
Right. We've contrasted David's lingering gaze with Joseph's strategic flight. We've examined the neurobiology of internal paralysis and the absolute necessity of radical digital amputation.
Cutting off the access.
And finally, we've explored replacing the dehydrating salt water of endless consumption with the fresh water of divine satisfaction.
It really is a profound shift in how to view our daily decisions.
It is. But before we conclude today's discussion, I want to leave our beloved family members with a final thought that expands on this framework.
Oh, please do.
We've focused intensely today on digital habits and romantic or sexual desires. But if C.S. Lewis's diagnosis in the sermon is accurate, that our most destructive, impulsive cravings are actually misdirected hungers for the divine, what other seemingly mundane areas of our lives are we currently drowning in salt water?
Oh, man. That is a terrifying but necessary question.
Where else are we settling for instant, dehydrating gratification simply because we have forgotten the taste of true satisfaction?
Like outside of just digital stuff.
Exactly. Is it in our relentless pursuit of career success where we sacrifice our health for a promotion? Is it in our desperate need for social approval and likes? Are these simply different flavors of salt water?
Wow.
Are we allowing neon graffiti to obscure other beautiful masterpieces in our lives while ignoring the fresh water right in front of us?
That is exactly what we all need to sit with today. Where are we pouring gasoline on the wrong sparks? And where do we desperately need to change our environment? Thank you so much to our beloved family members for joining us on this exploration. We hope this analysis of the sermon's insights has provided you with a new lens for reclaiming the original beauty in your own life. Until next time, take care.